This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is Peter Day's World of Business. I'm Peter Day, and this download edition of Global Business from the BBC World Service is an encounter with two authors with important things to say about how companies need to change and how they might try to steer themselves into a rather uncertain future. Hello and welcome to Global Business on the BBC World Service. I'm Peter Day, and this week's programme dives into the shelves of recently published business books to hear from two authors with ideas about how companies need to change and how they might try to steer themselves into a rather uncertain future. First, let's hear from a professor at London Business School, where she's been teaching management practice for 25 years, after starting working life as a company psychologist. Linda Grattan has written several international bestsellers about work, companies and innovation, and she's the founder of what's called the Hot Spots Movement. It's a club of people who want to make their companies buzz with energy. Linda Grattan has been called one of the top business thinkers in the world. Her latest book is The Key. In it, she says that corporations can survive and prosper by tackling the world's toughest problems, such as poverty and climate change and youth unemployment. And these are real jobs for businesses to tackle. Linda Grattan starts the book with something that many readers will find a bit uncomfortable after the recent years of financial and commercial crisis in so many parts of the world. She begins unashamedly with a love letter to big companies, something I must say I found a bit hard to take.
To have a love letter to corporations, yes, I absolutely agree. They're more likely to get hate letters.
Quite rightly, too. They betrayed our trust. I grew up trusting companies, businesses, all sorts of things, to deliver the goods and services I want. And yes, they did, but they were doing it now turns out, in dangerous and underhand ways. I'm generalising wildly, but I think you know what I mean.
But, you know, the simple truth is, Peter, that they are part of the fabric of our lives. We fly in their aeroplanes, we drink their milk, we use their underground tubes. I mean, they are what holds our society together in many ways. And so what I've tried to do is really to argue that we have to have expectations of them.
You want them to raise their game. I think there was a time when companies doing industrial capitalism were doing good things. And I think at some stage in the 80s, something else took over, financial capitalism, bosses, leaders driven by money. And something changed to the idea of the corporation. We're still living in the aftermath of that very severe change.
Well, let me put it this way. There are three things that large corporations do better than any institution in the whole world. First, innovation and research and development. Corporations spend more on that than any other institution. Secondly, scaling and mobilising. If Save the Children want to get water to people in Africa, they use the Coca-Cola supply chain. I mean, they're better. They know how to scale. They know how to mobilise. And thirdly, they're extraordinary at building alliances. If you think about the alliances that are behind Vodafone, for example, working across the world. So why don't we acknowledge that? And why don't we now ask companies to do more with that and to build resilience in a world that's becoming increasingly fragile? And that resilience is about what they do inside to their own people, what they do to their communities and supply chain, but also how they tackle some of the world's big issues, such as climate change and youth unemployment.
They got the methodology anyway. I think we can agree on that. They can distribute well. They can get things to people well. I question innovation, though. Does innovation really happen in great big companies anymore?
But even being able to build an ecosystem that brings innovative people in, that itself is extraordinary. I mean, I'm not suggesting that every single innovation happens in a large company. Of course it doesn't. But what large companies are good at is creating opportunities for people to then really leverage their skills and capabilities. You know, large corporations, unless you're taking a Luddite view, are the reality of our world. And I think that given that they are the reality, why don't we ask more of them?
Well, it depends who you're asking more of. If you're asking that for an accountant, and accountants run many Western businesses, then he or she sees the world almost entirely in terms of quarterly profits. And that pressure on them does not produce anything long-term that begins to allow them to satisfy anything other than the bottom line quarter after quarter.
So why can't we ask more of them? Why can't we ask corporations and leaders to take a longer-term view? And some of them are doing that. And it seems to me that if we as citizens, as consumers, can ask something of them, why can't we create a world where organisations are prepared to think in the long term as well as the short term? Look, there's no doubt that some organisations do bad things at some times. You just have to look at the films that are being made to realise that there's no positive film about a corporation. But the truth is that corporations produce the goods and services that we are happy to buy and happy to use, and in some cases to a very high quality. And if you talk to their employees, and we do this all the time, many employees say, I like working for this company, I find it interesting, I like my work. My research over the last 10 years has looked at the future of work. And the future of work, as you know, has got some pretty tough elements about it. It's my view that corporations need to now prepare themselves for the future to build resilience, both inside and outside.
Let's flash back to Milton Friedman's famous article in the New York Times, where he said the only duty of the corporation was to its shareholders. And that was pretty influential, wasn't it? That justified the release of market forces in political thinking in a way that had kind of been kept in a box until then, had been argued about. Are you trying to turn back market forces?
I think there's many people who would argue with that right now. I mean, it's very interesting that at London Business School we have a couple of professors who have done very large data sets which look at whether corporations who believe themselves to be socially responsible and do socially responsible things outperform those that don't. And actually, the interesting thing is that they do. They financially outperform. So it isn't an either-or world. It's an and-and world, because companies who are good at doing stuff are also good at understanding their neighbourhood, and they're also good at understanding some of the problems they face. So if you can use those capabilities, I mean, look, for example, at the IT companies in India. The Indian education system is failing and has failed. Now, what Wipro and Infosys, TCS, have done is they have taken responsibility for the education of millions of Indian children.
They were companies kind of made possible and created by the fact that Indian government decided to produce college centres of excellence, particularly in Bangalore, and out of them streamed millions of technically proficient people.
Yes.
So they're using their people who benefited from a very specific Indian education, which has worked fantastically well, to do?
Well, to build an education. But I mean, many of them, by the way, also went to California, and so they're also returning diaspora. But what you see in India is companies stepping in. And a company like TCS,
Tata Consulting Services,
now 310,000 people around the world, grows at 20%. I mean, that's doing a lot about youth unemployment, which frankly, I think the two real challenges we face from a work perspective in the world is climate change and youth unemployment. And those are exactly the sort of problems that companies that can tackle.
Professor Grattan pins her faith for the future on the individuals who work for a company.
We should see corporations for what they are, which is collections of people. Collections of people, I believe, who generally want to do good. Now, you know, Peter called me an old-fashioned humanist, but I think, in general, people want to do good. I think large institutions are a place that they can do good, and I think we should acknowledge that, and rather than run away from them and say how bad they are, I think we should say to organisations and those that lead them, you are a part of our world. We want you now to be a force for good. And I think they can be, because they have a lot of resources. And I'm not just talking about money. They've got scaling and mobilising, research and development, and alliance building capabilities.
I think so many corporations are now distracted from making really good products and services by other considerations, such as a financial quarterly reporting bottom line, for example. It's all about, isn't it, delivering really good stuff at a very reasonable price to as many people as possible. That's what a company's about.
Yeah, but that's to assume that that's just about the time people pay working. I mean, work is full of distractions. Look at all those emails that we all are distracted by constantly. There's no reason in the world why a company or a group of people can't both do something well and do something good. There's absolutely no evidence that those two things are impossible. And what I want to do is to show that you can do both. You can both be a force for good and be a decent, high-performing company.
In the same offices with the same people, rather than allowing people time off to work on their own to do something else outside the clamp of the corporation?
Well, if you had to choose between saying to your senior executives, we want you to go to a local school and paint it, versus we want you to use and leverage what you're already good at to make a difference, I would say leverage what happens inside a company. You know, General Mills, this research guy there.
This is the breakfast cereal company?
Yes.
Or I mean, at least now probably much more than that, but yes.
One of the things that one of the head scientists was doing is that they were packing up food. He was acting as a volunteer, packing up food and sending it to Africa. And he said, why am I wasting my time packing up food, sending it to Africa? Why don't we do something about the food chain in Africa? Because the real problem with Africa in terms of its food chain is that the food rots in the shops. How can we make food so it doesn't rot so quickly and so on? That was a question he asked himself. He used his own core competencies. You know, Peter, we've been going on about corporations for years as a place of core competencies. That's what they should be using. Not just giving people time off to work, to actually leverage what a company can do into the wider world.
Yeah, but I have to put it to you, because this is what listeners will be saying. A breakfast cereal company doing this is a distraction which makes it feel good and its shareholders feel good and its public relations people have a good story to tell to the outside world, where meanwhile on the production lines making the cereals, they are loading our children with sugary food. It's a distraction from what they're really doing, and it's a very good story to tell, but it gets in the way of what they are actually doing at the heart of the corporation, or distracts from it.
Of course, there's lots of things that corporations do which I don't like and you don't like, and putting sugar in food is one of them. However, that doesn't take away from the fact that actually there is within General Mills the capability to make a difference to organisations. And research shows that corporations who do good in their society over-deliver in terms of financial performance. It's not either or, it's an and. And isn't that an extraordinary way to think about large corporations? Isn't it great that we can say to them, we want you to make a difference? And then I think we can attract a lot more people to go and work with them. Maybe in 10 years' time, when I ask my MBA students, do you want to be a CEO? They'll say, yes, we do.
Professor Linda Grattan, full of hope about beneficial change in the world, which could be created by corporations thinking hard about where they operate. Her new book is called The Key. This is Global Business from the BBC. I'm Peter Day, this week hearing about two new books about business. Now to someone who might disagree with the innovating skills that Professor Grattan praises in those big corporations. He's a Danish author with an international following from his job as a management consultant with a New York firm called Innovation Architects. The new book by Thomas Weddell Weddelsborg is called Innovation as Usual. most companies know they have to pursue innovation, but, he argues, too often they're inspired by great disruptors such as the late Steve Jobs, co-founder of Apple Computers, and many other things. So corporations tend to tackle innovation as a sort of sideline that they turn on for special occasions. This is, says Thomas W.W., a wrong approach to innovation. It ought to be bred into the way a business operates all the time, and it's hard to do, he says.
Innovation, in a sense, there's a great fatigue surrounding the topic. What people get wrong about it is that it isn't necessarily something stellar or something that puts you on the front page of all the news magazines. In reality, it's just finding a way of creating results.
That sounds rather like coalface grunt work. It's not Steve Jobs stuff. It's not disruptive necessarily.
I would agree. I mean, one of the big misperceptions of creativity is that it's this fun and games process. And I think most people who actually work with producing creative output, well, they know that there's a lot of grunt work involved. It isn't necessarily all laughter all the way to the bank.
And the way that conventional organizations go about innovation is an away day or a brainstorming session or lots of brainstorming sessions when you're allowed to be different from normal just for the day.
Yes, we call it the excursion to Brainstorm Island, and it is a bit of a trope in organizations. You go away for 2 days, there's a lot of talk about the future and new technology, and you brainstorm on new exciting projects.
And it's very buzzy. You feel terrific as a result of it.
Absolutely.
You can challenge the bosses and all kinds of good stuff.
For 2 days a year. and I think that's the core problem. The whole philosophy that approach is based on is that creativity is something exceptional. That you go off, you do it 2 days a year, and nobody really pays attention to the other 363 days a year. How can we make those more innovative?
And you're taken seriously as a disruptor, as an outrageous maker of outrageous statements and outrageous ideas for those 2 days. Then you come back and you sit at your seat or in your cubicle or something and you realise that nothing has changed. So it actually makes it worse, not better, because the ideas can then be dismissed as, oh, it was just our brainstorming session.
Yeah. It creates a great scepticism, especially employees who've been with the company for a while and they've been on 2-3 of those excursions before. They know what that game is about, and that you actually create, I would argue, a worse mood, at least if you don't manage to follow up on what happens on the island, so to speak.
So what is your different idea about innovation?
Well, fundamentally, that innovation is a set of behaviors, and that set of behaviors, the challenge that leaders have to answer is how to integrate that into daily life. And often that means stripping a lot of the trappings of creativity, the Hawaii shirt, the crazy behavior, and so on, and actually saying, well, we have the culture we have in the company. Now, given that, instead of sitting and saying, how do we have more brainstorm meetings, well, how do we take, for instance, our ordinary meetings and make those better at fostering innovation? How can we, in a very basic way, help people get better at developing ideas and turning them into results?
Let's think about something you're very keen on. It's what happened at the pharmaceutical giant Pfizer 8-9 years ago, something like that.
There's a manager inside the company by the name of Jordan Cohen, we've written quite a bit about him, who has an idea for how to make people's lives easier and how to make them more productive, basically by outsourcing the boring parts of their job. And the interesting thing was the way he went about creating that innovation, because he didn't really have any support from the top to do it. So he manages to build it from scratch.
He was in HR, was he?
He was in HR in organizational effectiveness.
So he was kind of thinking about these things. He
Absolutely.
Had a right to think about these things.
And he had an expertise in that area that I think was relevant. What struck me as most fascinating, well, one thing he did right was to start out with very small experiments. The first time he tries it, it's with 6 people. But what struck me as most interesting was the way he navigated the political challenges or the environment around innovation. Typically a very big barrier to people working in companies. Most pharmaceutical businesses, Pfizer included, tend to be very bureaucratic, they are rule-bound, they are regulated very heavily. And as a consequence, if you work in a pharmaceutical, you probably don't perceive yourself as a creative person in that sense of the word.
He worked small, tried it out, and then got relationships with mentors or protectors just above him in the organization?
Partially, he had been there for a few years, and he had already existing, well, friendships, and he managed to use those to screen himself from some of the negative consequences of failing. It's very easy to go out and say, oh, we should take more risk and fail more, but in most organizations, that's not a good way to go. You get penalized for it. So when he, for instance, chose to test it, well, he picked six friends. Because he, well, one thing, they would give him honest feedback, but more importantly, they wouldn't backstab him in the canteen the next day and sit down and say, this Jordan guy, he's off his rockers. So I think managing that, getting senior people on board who know how to get stuff done in the organization is critical.
That's a sort of organizational change at Pfizer that became quite big, did it?
It did. I think already by 2008, they had gotten something like 10,000 people on board internally. That was by then, I think, 10% of Pfizer's total workforce.
And that brings up, I think, a fundamental question, and that is whether great big corporations are really suitable for innovation. Yes, you can do change, you can tweak a bit, you can get processes nicer so that people are more involved. But are they really innovators? When we look at the history of the early 21st century, aren't the great disruptive innovators nearly all very small things run by one or two people when they start off?
I would say that there are two parts to the innovation game, and the first part is indeed to identify the need and build a solution for it. Where I think big companies do have an advantage is in scaling it. And innovation isn't just about coming up with a creative thing. It's actually getting it out into the world to make a real impact. Your comment brings to light an interesting distinction within innovation, which is the long term versus the short term. And there are some things like drug development, which is by nature a long term 15-year game. What interested me is that there are also a lot of examples of much shorter term impact things, which are more doable outside the R&D environment, where most of us work. One example, historic example that I use a lot is the invention of the rolling suitcase, which happened in 1972, or in other words, in the span of human history, first we put a man on the moon and then we put wheels on suitcases.
And it's now so accepted you don't think it was ever invented, but it was.
And there's a lot of good ideas that have that quality of when you look at it, you're kind of, why didn't we come up with that before? That's where people working outside the R&D department can make a difference in terms of getting better at those types of innovations, if you will.
But there's something else about the rolling suitcase, isn't there?
Well,
it didn't roll in quite the same way when it was invented, did it?
Exactly that. The first rolling suitcases were like leather boxes, four squeaky metal wheels, and a leash you dragged it in.
It was like a dog on wheels.
A drunken dog, arguably. And basically, it took 15 years to improve that design. It wasn't until 1987 that somebody turns the suitcase on its side, adds a telescope pole to make it easier to drag.
And who was that somebody?
Not somebody in the luggage industry. It was a pilot.
Who used these things and was so frustrated by the near usability of them that he tilted the suitcase.
Exactly. His name was Robert Platt, and he quit his job, he formed a company, and he got rich off that invention 15 years after the original invention. Here's a user that spots a problem and fixes it. The question I ask myself is what the next iteration in that space is. What's the next luggage thing?
It's luggage that delivers itself to you at the conveyor belt, isn't it?
The luggage example is interesting in that context because the real problem I'm facing is I need my clothes in Tokyo or wherever I'm traveling to. And the solution to that may not need to involve a suitcase. If it's a suit, can somebody lend me a suit out there? Or is there a way for FedEx and UBS and all the transportation companies to come up with a solution where I don't have to take the suitcase with me? The core insight here is when you ask people to innovate around luggage, they tend to zoom in on the object. They look at the suitcase and they say, could we make it lighter? Could we make it more trackable or whatever? A better starting point is to go in and first analyze what's the actual problem we're trying to solve. And is there a different way of thinking about that problem? That tends to lead to more interesting outcomes from an innovation perspective.
The innovation you're talking about most of the time is pretty basic stuff. That is, it occurs at lower levels in a company and might not be very visible to the outside world, might it?
Not necessarily. I think a lot of these things don't end up on the front page of Business Week or whatever. And for that reason, I think sometimes in the public imagination, we have a too great obsession with disruptive innovation. You know, it's like a plane crash compared to a car crash. That disruptive innovation, when it happens, it's big and you really notice it and you become scared that that will happen to your business as well. When you look at car crashes, well, then less dramatic, but they are much more frequent. It's actually more dangerous to drive a car than it is to fly a plane. And yet I think a lot of companies underestimate the danger of not getting small part innovation right, instead of focusing only on the big disruptive changes.
Now, one of the best-known, fairly recent arguments about corporate innovation comes from the Harvard Business School professor Clayton Christensen, what he calls the innovator's dilemma. It traps companies who start off with a radical innovation, like a cheap car for the masses, Henry Ford, but then innovate year by year by improving it, only to be eventually eclipsed by new outsiders who come along with radically new ways of car manufacture, like the Japanese firms. How real is the innovator's dilemma for Thomas Weddell Weddellsborg?
I had the pleasure of co-teaching a program with Clay Christensen here recently, and I think the framework he came up with back in, was it 95, around sustaining versus disruptive innovation has since shaped a lot of our thinking around this. I do believe it's very powerful. What I think a lot of people miss out on is a subtle distinction in the theory he came out with, where he looks at sustaining innovations. Well, those are the ones that don't destroy your business model, which is nice. And within that, there are actually two different categories. There's incremental, and there's what he calls radical. The existence of the potential for radical impact within your current business model is sometimes underestimated. I think we're too fast at categorizing it either as, oh, it's disruptive, or it's very incremental and it doesn't really matter. There is the potential for creating radical results by doing what you do better. Having said that, I'm a little bit more skeptical of this whole call it open innovation. It's a big buzzword at the moment, and there are truths to it. I saw a study here from Robert Cooper, who is the inventor of the StageGate process, where he looked at, asked companies where they saw good ideas coming from. And consistently, they, you know, the methods where you just go out and ask consumers, they didn't really tend to pay off. Consumers generally can't tell you what they want. What tended to work best was actually when you took your own employees and you immersed them in the world of the customer and let them ideate around that. It does come from inside.
I buy your book at an airport and read it on the plane and come back to my organization. I'm fairly near the top, I suppose, and I want to do it. What do I ask you to do? Do I know what I want you to do? How does innovation work when it's sort of like that?
I would say it starts with understanding from a strategic perspective what you're trying to achieve. Because innovating for the sake of being creative is not a very good thing for companies to do.
Except if you want more employee involvement, it might be the point.
That might be your purpose. And I did see that one example where very clearly the leadership says, our mission here is to create more employee engagement and to specifically lower the rate of staff turnover, because that costs us a lot. Now, that to me is a clear objective. But if you don't enunciate that, if you don't say this is what we're going for, then people will run in wildly different directions with this innovation thing. The challenges aren't technical. I mean, in R&D, often they are, but for many innovations, it's not so much a question of can we invent the technology, but more can we spot the need and can we find a simple, better way of fixing it and can we navigate the internal political issues.
Thomas Weddell Weddellsborg, co-author of the new book, Innovation as Usual, on the airport bookstore shelves now, along with the other book we heard about, Linda Grattan's The Key. You know, innovation used to be a word that one of the editors of this program banned us from mentioning. Too boring, he thought. He is, I must say, no longer with us.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.